That music makes me so nostalgic. That's actually from my country, Trinidad. That's the Lara brothers, Antonio, Tito, Willie, and Victor, the oldest parang band in my home country of Trinidad and Tobago, with La Gaita, the flute. At this time of year in Trinidad, we see the resurgence of this music, influenced, in fact, given to the country by Afro-Venezuelans coming to Trinidad and keeping their culture, the music, and of course, this became part of the culture of Trinidad, where everybody is. Everybody from all over the world just decided to land in Trinidad and Tobago. So the Lara brothers are legendary. They're all gone now. The last of was Willie. He died on May the 9th this year. But this music, we called it parang. I guess in Puerto Rico and other places, you called it parranda. Now, here's how it works. They sneak up to your house. You're supposed to pretend you don't see them coming. And they break out in song around Christmas time. They come to your house, they go house to house. And of course, you show them the hospitality of your home by bringing out your rum and your cake and whatever, your roast pork, whatever it is you got. And it's a lot of merrymaking and it's a wonderful time. We used to have a parang come to our house. It was just wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. So today we hear from the Lara brothers and we are going to hear from the queen of parang, the late Daisy Voisin. And she is still revered as the great queen of this particular cultural art form. And it is interesting, she too has her roots in Venezuela and coming to Trinidad. So this time of year, I look forward to it. We should have parang all year, but I really love this art form. So you're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. It is Free Your Mind Friday on this Friday, December the 26th. And it's the last of the Free Your Mind Fridays for 2014. Your call at 888-874-4888 on issues of importance to you. It's free. Just free form, do what you need to do. But let's have a conversation as opposed to a monologue. Let's, tell us things that we should be thinking, as opposed to, just telling us off. All right, that's good. All right, we start with Joel from New York. Hello, Joel.
Good afternoon, Trees. I hope you had a very good holiday.
I was able to spend it with some really good friends.
Oh, that's wonderful. I thought I would talk a little bit about stuff that I think is extraordinarily important and sheds light on the sort of character of U.S. policy throughout the world, but tends not to be talked about very much. And that is the expansion of the U.S. empire throughout North Africa and the Middle East. That expansion, to a large extent, has been built around arming and financing vassal states that serve as military outposts of the empire. We tend to think about the wars that we fight and focus all of our attention on that and forget about this. And these vassal rulers, whether it's in Israel, Turkey, or Jordan, or Yemen, or Iraq, or Bahrain, or Saudi Arabia, these vassal regimes are ruled for the most part by dictatorial monarchies and authoritarian civilian rulers. And even if they're democracies, they're jailhouse democracies, like Israel. And to a large extent, they rely on force and violence to sustain their rule. And the U.S. over the decades has supplied weapons and advisors and financing that allow them to rule. And as a result, the arc of imperial military bases stretches, if you look at a map, from Egypt right through Israel, Turkey, Jordan, Yemen, of course, Iraq, Bahrain, and Saudi Arabia. And it's protected by a chain of prison camps containing tens of thousands of political prisoners, many of whom, of course, are tortured. And so the U.S. engagement and its its pervasive presence throughout the region is really a kind of manifestation of what a chain of jailhouse democracies and dictatorships are. And for over 50 years, U.S. policy has actively sought out, installed, and protected many of these bloody tyrants who've pillaged the public treasury, concentrated wealth, and surrendered sovereignty of their own economies. And what we get, in effect, is academics, pro-Israel academics, and the propagandists in universities, think tanks, and the press blaming the victims, blaming the Arab people, the Turkish people, and ignoring the role of U.S. empire builders in financing and arming the authoritarian civilian and military rulers and absolutist monarchies and their corrupt military, judicial, and police officials. So this is the kind of thing that's not talked about. And the opposition to this is never talked about. And there are plenty of opposition. There's plenty of opposition in the Middle East to this. There are student movements. We saw this in Egypt. There are trade unionists, many of whom are women. There are the unemployed. There are nationalist intellectuals. And there are Islamic forces that aren't violent and secular forces who oppose the empire for very practical and obvious reasons. So I thought that I would mention this because along with Israel, the U.S. is the main organizer of this vast chain of political prison camps that are really destroying the most creative and dynamic forces in the region. And as a result, this kind of Arab vassalage provokes the periodic explosion of vibrant democratic culture and movement. Unfortunately, it also results in greater U.S. military aid and presence and the repression of these movements, as we're seeing in Egypt today.
Thank you for getting us started today. Okay. Thank you, Joel. From Dallas, Sarah, you're on the air.
Oh, greetings to you, Utrice.
Thank you, and to you too.
Yes, Utrice, let me start off by wishing you an enjoyable rest of the year, as well as to the PRN listening audience. And are you still in back east, Utrice, or you made it back to the south?
No, I'm still here.
You're still in the east. Okay, so you're going to go back after the celebration for Dr. Clark?
It's Dr. Clark's celebration comes up on January the 9th.
The 9th. Yes, ma'am. Okay, so just give us another reminder. And I was told that you're going to be having some DVDs of the event for those of us who can't make it live in person. So those are going to be available for sale, right? So that we can...
We will have some, yes, we will have DVDs available. But the most important thing is to gather together to just celebrate the work of this great, great man, this great scholar, and we call him our master teacher. And
yes,
that's,
ma'am.
He was most proud of that.
Yes, ma'am, or Baba. So we're going to be looking forward to that event. Utrice, as soon as you get everything together, if you can just let us know, and we'll go ahead and check those out, you know, to get caught up with what's going on. But today, Utrice, for the new year, to try and get some of these things off of my mind before this new upcoming year. I was Ali expressed my sentiments exactly when she called in after that. The representative from the Latino Police Officers Association who was on your show and what he had to say, because to me, he seems to be a bit very slanted, and I guess by him being a police officer, he's going to come down on that side because that's your career, those are your friends, and you have people in that. But everything that he was trying, what he said on the show, he made it seem as if though cops' lives are more valuable, more important than the actual people that they're supposed to be patrolling and protecting and serving. It's as if though that when these cops who are alleged to have been killed by this black person, that okay, we're gonna ramp everything up, we're gonna make everything at the highest level because two of ours were taken out. But the statistics have shown that they are police officers more likely to die in a traffic stop, in a domestic situation, or them taking their lives than they are in the one or two incidents where they might encounter civilians, citizens on the street and get into a confrontation with them and they get taken out. The chances of that happening to them is not as high statistically as they're trying to make it up to be. So for them to make this an all-out war, it shows you that this was an there was something else going on in the scene. And as you laid out the timeline to show the tracking that is being done, how they can track this person all the way from Baltimore, minus a few gaps here and there, to show where he was, and then give us all of these fuzzy things to say, okay, he was the one that did the killing, and then he actually took himself out. And what you said, Eutrice, is that is like when black people are involved in these things, they always like to put a mental health angle to it. It's always that we are mentally off where we go, or if we kill ourselves or we shoot. Why couldn't it not be that after being involved in living in a condition that we have been forced to exist in, that some people see an out of it in order to punish people or to take themselves out of a situation that they find to be very unattainable for them to live under? Why is it that it always have to be? Because this is not normal to live like this. It is not a normal situation for us to live like this. So to always try and put a mental angle spin on it, because, Eutrice, when those couples who were tied to Clive and Bundy out in Nevada, when they went on that spree and they killed those two cops in Vegas, and then they went to Walmart and they shot this other woman at the Walmart, you didn't see that they did all of this ramped up security and says, okay, they're tied to a separatist group. They have these fringe elements and all of these things that we really and truly need to get to a higher level and we need to do something about that. They didn't do that. That individual out there in Pennsylvania, when he went and he shot that state trooper and he was hiding out in the Poconos for over a month, and then they finally found him, and then they brought him in unscathed. They didn't go to all of that level, and these people are separatist people who have these fringe animals with the Oath Keepers and all of these other Aryan nations and white supremacist groups that they are a member of. You did not see them declare war on them, but unless you show who it exactly is the target and who they're at war with, because this one black person, who they can't find him associated with anyone else, but the minute that they allege that he did these killings, all of a sudden they declare war on black folks.
Let's revisit some of the things that you said. Number one, I did not get from Tony Miranda, who is the executive chairman of the National Latino Officers Association, I did not get from him that he posited that the lives of the police officers were more important than the lives of the rest of us. I got exactly the opposite. In fact, he said everybody's life is important. And he is, of course, I recognize that he's talking or was talking as a former police officer. And therefore, he said that, and this is part of the culture. The police departments of all over the United States, people are encouraged, and the department, the police officers are encouraged to see themselves, as he said, the expression of the state. And you can't argue with that, whether it is right or wrong, but that is exactly how the culture regards police. That's why they're making a huge fuss over the fact that two officers were killed, as opposed to any other regular people killed. This is in fact, I'm not suggesting that it's the right way to think, but this is how the state apparatus is viewed and how it insists on being viewed. So that is the reality that we're dealing with. That's the consciousness. That's the philosophy. That's the operating scenario that we have to deal with.
I understand all of that, Eutrice.
But the second thing, I want to address the point that you made. The point you made about the mental health. I, in fact, raised the mental health question because in the two briefings that I shared with the audience, by the same people, the police commissioner, the head of detectives for the department, and the head of detectives for Brooklyn, they're all saying at the same time they said that they verified and they ascertained that this was a very troubled young man. that he had had mental illness issues going back a long way. His own family attested to that. His mother, his sister, his friends, they all suggested that there was a problem with this young man for quite a long time. And at the same time that they said that, they said, however, he was anti-police and anti-government. Mm-hmm. So it seemed as if the anti-government, quote, and anti-police, quote, sentiments outweighed, in their view, outweighed any motive than for his actions than mental illness. And I was talking about the fact that mental illness here, we need to have experts come forward now and really deal with this question, because this is a pervasive problem, and we need to understand the correlation between oppression, just as you said, oppression and this kind of behavior. And what is the link between the two? Because we've seen this kind of behavior before, and it is not to explain it or is not to excuse it or condone it, but it is to understand that there may be something here that we need as a society to understand. And that was my point.
Yes, Utrecht. And both of your points are well taken, but what I would come back to when you were speaking about the mental health angle versus the anti-police, anti-government rant that they went on, and the anti-police, mm-hmm. anti-government weighed out more than the mental health. What they're trying to do, as you said, is that if you're anti-police, anti-government, then you've got a mental health issue, because you're not supposed to be these things. But if you take everything into the proper context, if you have a people, all of us have a touch of mental health issues with us, Utrecht. Because if you're living in a racist, white supremacist society that we are living in, where you are not allowed to be the full person that you were intended to be when you were created, then you're going to develop certain psychosis. And we all have a touch of mental illness. Some of us can contain it and survive in this society and manage it and exist in this society, because that's all we're doing. We are existing. We are not living a normal existence as a result of what we've been put under. And
correct.
Some of us have been able to manage it. But some of us, correct. We come to a point where it's going to be boiling over, and the police are... These law enforcement agencies, they are not taking accountability for themselves. They always... And this is the thing that gets on my nerves. They always like to push personal responsibility on us. That's okay. You need to take personal responsibility for your children and having children out of wedlock and all of the nonsense that they say. But when law enforcement don't want to take personal responsibility for the way how they come in and they be an occupying force in the community they're supposed to be serving, they're not accepting
exactly,
that.
Exactly. You're correct. And we have all of these contradictions to deal with. And that's my point. The City Council of New York, which has direct responsibility to supervise or to control the police department and even the mayor.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's asking for accountability at this level. How could you have a police commissioner with a department that is doing the kinds of things that we are seeing and have been seeing for many, many years? And this is across the country. So we have to deal with these things. When it comes to understanding the relationship between oppression and this kind of explosive violence, even to the point of turning it inward, we could look, for example, to the parallel of Paulo Freire. He's an educator who really turned the tide around in terms of education. What is the relationship to oppression and poverty and education? And therefore, he fashioned an entirely different approach to reaching those children who were completely disfranchised, and then pioneered a whole different approach to education, which was completely revolutionary. Mm-hmm. The same thing, I think, has to happen here. We need this kind of help, and we need it from the community. We need it from the community affected
exactly.
to to come to grips with this and help the community deal with this, because we're seeing way too many instances of the dynamic playing out, and we need the force being placed on the city apparatus and the state apparatus to correct itself and to force the correction. And we're not seeing it here at all.
Exactly, Utrecht, because the mayor came in under a reform ticket. That's what he ran on that platform. And if one of the first things his idea of reform is to bring back in the architect that started this whole broken policies that is on right now, and I don't hear any outcry from the community saying that Patton has got to go. This is one of the things that they need to put pressure on City Hall to tell the mayor that you're going to have to get rid of Bratton. We're going to run a recall election, you know, whatever the time limit is, the state of New York or city of New York, for them to run a campaign to do a recall to get him out of office. That is what they're going to have to do, because if you're breaking all of these promises within 11 months or less than 11 months of you being in office, it's already going to show the people what they have to look forward to for the next 3 years.
Exactly. You put a feast here on the table today.
Thank you.
We're following Joel. There's a lot here to cogitate upon. Thank you so much, sir, for
your
call today. From Philadelphia, Clara, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. Happy holidays to you, Utrecht, and my
thank
fellow
you.
Listeners. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. And Okay. Thank you so much for that.
I'm calling because today I want to talk a little bit more about things I've been thinking about concerning focus, and I know a word that's not a term that's not easily accepted by a lot of people, personal responsibility, and I'm not talking about the kind that I've heard about on your program where people are deriding other people and saying they're not responsible. I'm just saying there are ways that we can do things to become more powerful, and it does involve personal responsibility. For instance, when I go to a demonstration, I don't go there to fit anything from the power structure. I expect nothing. I go there as a part of a group to disrupt the system. Then when I go home, I don't go to Walmart or any of those places. I don't turn on my television. I focus on empowering myself so that I'll be ready for this battle that we're already in. And I think that gets to the other part. We focus a lot on racism. That's just the tip of the iceberg. What we're dealing with now is fascism. And if we don't come to terms with that and get it in our heads, that's the issue. It's the system. That system breeds racism. It breeds all kinds of gender discrimination. It breeds poor health. It breeds everything. But if we are going to tackle each and every problem individually, we lose. And that's why when I'm in conversations with people, and when I read, I read about what fascism is. I know quite a bit about it. I know how it works. I think we gotta kill the system, kill this beast. I call it starving the beast. That means you don't support it. You can't go out, you can't talk on a radio program about all you know that's going on, and then go to your own little demonstration, and then go on your way home, you stop in Walmart's or Lord & Taylor's. And I mean, it's got to be total, because this is serious. That's all I'm saying. I'm not criticizing people. I'm trying to wake people up and get a conversation, and maybe I'll be more awakened by the conversation. But people don't want to talk about it, Utrecht. The people I meet,
this system that you just described, what is this fascist system?
What is it?
Yes.
I'm talking about what we're living under, Utrecht, the whole thing, the government, the corporations. That's where everything is dominated by corporations. That's fascism. Our health system, our educational system more and more, our food more and more. What else is there? You go out and you demonstrate, they spray you. You can be lying on the street and they might spray you. Killing people in the street? I mean, it's not going to stop until the system is dismantled. And now they're going to dismantle it on their own eventually. But we can't keep contributing to it.
Why do you say they would dismantle it on their own?
I'm sorry. Oh, everything is being done in the world. I mean, the climatic, you know, destroying the planet by all the pollution, all the things they're doing in the nuclear waste. They just released a lot of nuclear waste from Fukushima. You know, there are many people dying now already, young people dying of cancer. That, the wars, we're not going to win these wars. We're just not. Economically, we're in deep trouble. We're in such debt, we'll never pay it back. They're going to start stealing from us, taking our bank accounts. I mean, it's total. I don't see the medical system is in a rage. It's just in a terrible situation. They're finding every day the kind of problems they're having and the devastation that they're wreaking upon the public. I mean, I know now if a person gets diabetes, I tell these people, stay away from those people. You cure yourself. All those medicines they put you on, the wrong diet. I mean, everything I see in that system that we live under is lethal and toxic. If you can tell me something that isn't, I would gladly listen.
Well, this is for everybody else to tell you today. So this is the forum, and I'm glad that you brought this and put it on the table. We'll see how people react. But thank you so much, Clara, for contributing so profoundly today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. We'll take this little break with the great, wonderful Parang. We're continuing from our country, Trinidad and Tobago. Daisy Voisin is going to be treating us to a little something called Goipe or Lelolai. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it is the last Free Your Mind Friday for 2014. 888-874-4888. That was Daisy Voisin with Lelolai. So we have from New York, Ma'at, you're on the air.
Season's greetings to the beloved PRN family. First, I want to share a short piece from a publication called The Week. the U.S. and international media, unquote, and I'll add mainly from the mainstream, December 12th. It says, its headline, only in America, 9 Cleveland police officers who killed 2 unarmed African Americans in a hail of 137 bullets in 2012 are suing the city, claiming they were unfairly punished because they are not black. The killings of Timothy Russell, Melissa Williams, who were each shot more than 20 times, came after cops mistook their car backfiring for a gunshot. The officers were suspended with pay for 3 days for the killings, but claimed they were unfairly subjected to an unofficial punishment, quote-unquote, because of their race. So that makes the point around the fascism, and we must have a way to chart all of this, to document what is fascism. And I think Joel's point is certainly cogent, and the youth are starting to realize they must look outside their own issue of the police shootings and put-downs of blacks and maimings, et cetera, the empire and the imperial thrust. But the main point that I want to make is around what I introduced, and then another caller whose name I can't recall fleshed it out further, and that is the principle of the deep state. So when I was referencing Joyce Rowley of the Power Hour on GCN, that was an example, and she has a serious health crisis, so she's mostly not on these days. But when she is on, she starts out looking at the narrative that we're given through the news and says, what about this is not true? There's plenty of examples. Webster Tarpley has documented in, and he's on GCN. He's a progressive on there, called 9/11 Synthetic Terror. Bin Laden died in December of 2001, as reported in the international media and by top Albrecht, certain state officials, et cetera, and by Fox News. There's been some creations of crimes in fact, there was a documentary on HBO earlier this year about some developmentally disabled young Muslim or aspiring to be Muslims, and they were set up in terms of a created crime as to their seeing footage where they were coerced into this terrorism event, synagogue in Riverdale, and then it went before Congress as if they had done something other than created a whole scenario. So, and it goes on and on. Sandy Hook, Aurora, Chris Dunner. There are people like Jim Fetzer, Wolfgang Halberg, Professor James Turner in your state, who are analyzing and saying these things couldn't have happened the way that we're told that they happened.
All right.
And the caller who came after me, he was talking about, well, who got targeted? These weren't the people who shoot down blacks, and other aspects of the case where I think it's important that we don't take all these things at face value, as Amy Goodman does all the time.
Thank you so much for your call. And thank you for acknowledging the audience as well. Thank you so much. Hello, Harvey, from good old Berkeley, California.
Hello, wonderful Utrecht.
Hello, Harvey. How are you?
Very good, thank you, and hello to your wonderful audience, and top of the season to everyone. I'd like to speak about what I call the virus of hate. It's not really a virus, but it's a state of mind, but I call it the virus of hate because it seems to infect so many people, and it turns out that it says here in the last, at least 108 million people were killed in wars in the 20th century. Estimates for a total number of people killed in wars throughout human history range from 150 million to a billion people. And I find it's so easy to hate. It's like, especially groups, you know. And when you find that you start hating groups, then you've been infected. You are infected. You're part of the epidemic of hate. And I believe you're working for the Grim Reaper. That's one of the tools that the destructor takes people out of the planet. There's creation and destruction, and one of the tools of destruction is hate. If I find myself catching the hate cold, I sort of wake up right away and try to work on it so that I'm not caught up in that dynamic, because it takes over one's body, one's mind, and it puts everybody at risk, because especially when we're made to hate groups, there are many forces out there that want us to hate each other, and they're working along around the clock. They use fear. Fear is the prime motivator of hate. And so don't get caught. I say, you know, if we don't want to just end up just going on and on and on hating and killing each other, that we have to look inside. And I say 2015 is a good year to just say no to hate, and see if we can survive these things and figure them out without having to kill each other. Because, you know, when we see each other as the other, it's not helping anybody. And especially now with the new quantum physics, quantum entanglement, meaning that at the smallest levels, the smallest particles in the universe, there is this force of entanglement where if two electrons or photons are around each other, when they're separated, they're still connected. You affect one, the other is instantaneously affected. And if the Big Bang Theory is correct, that the universe sprang forth from a primordial atom, then we are all entangled according to physics. And so I feel that we have to check the hate at the door and become quantangled if we want to go on, especially in a life that is more than just hating and fearing each other.
Thank you. Very profound words today, and words we can use as we approach the new year, but we can use them every single day. Thank you very much, Harvey, for your call today. We go next to Chicago. Henry, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Eutrice?
Great. How are you?
I'm doing good. Want to wish all the PRN audience and you as well a happy holiday and a prosperous new year.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
I wanted to, since this being the last Free Your Mind Friday of the year, I wanted to thank you, Eutrice, because I started listening to you back in March, and this is my first time listening. This is the year I first, you know, started listening to you. And I want to thank you, to you, the guests you have, and to the callers about the amounts and amounts of information that I have. I feel like I'm so politically aware now this year than I have been since I started getting interested into politics. And other things that relate to social issues as well. I felt like I got so much out of this show, and I hope you could just be on the air for a very long time, because this is the type of information you typically don't get, you know, in mainstream media. And so I just want to thank you and thank the audience and thank your guests for this year that I've had with you guys, because it's been so, so valuable. And it's interesting, you've been advertising this event that's going to commemorate Dr. Clark's 100th anniversary at Concord. But it was a Concord
Convent.
Yeah.
Convent Baptist Church.
I'm going to try to make it out there. I'm going to try.
Wow.
Because
from Chicago, that would be great.
From Chicago. Well, I think I expressed this before. Dr. Clark has been one of my favorite historians. So it's like I got to be there, you know, to feel this energy that you know that these people, you know, have for Dr. Clark. And it's interesting because when I first discovered Dr. Clark, and through my watching, you know, all of his lectures that have been posted online, I got a chance to know about you because there's a video out there of a great debate that Dr. Clark had with Mary Lefkowitz.
Oh, no.
And it was so,
yeah,
I
remember that one.
Yes, and that was the first time I knew about you. So it was like, you know, as much as I was enamored with Dr. Clark and Martin Burnell, and it was sort of like, when I saw you, I was like, wow, this lady is, she's something. But it's so funny because, like I said, I accidentally found out about you through Dr. Clark, and I thought it would be appropriate to, you know, kind of be at, you know, be there January 9th, because if it wasn't for Dr. Clark, I wouldn't have known you.
Oh, that's it's wonderful. Thank you so much for all that you've said. The show means a great deal to me because I believe it. I mean, I really mean it. I learn a lot. There's so much education that goes on, and this has been the case in my years in broadcasting. The audience is the teacher as well. It's not just me. It's the audience. We all are in this together. And when you listen to the profound analyses that have been rendered just today, as an example, and you included, we get what is the perfect response, I think, to the conditions that we live under. And that is, we share with each other information that empowers. And that's incredible. It's an incredible use of the medium. And I think it is the best use of the medium. This event that we're hoping to have a wonderful testimonial from the community. He's gone, but it is his 100th year, and we need to lift up these people who have, like you experienced, turned our lives around by turning our knowledge of ourselves and our knowledge of our world around. And Dr. John Henrik Clark is one of those transformative people, and yet a very humble man, a very incredibly generous man, and who devoted his life to retrieving these missing pages of our history. So we must say thank you and do it the right way. And it would be wonderful to see your face there in the company of all the other people who, you would be like one of us. We are all admirers of Dr. John Henrik Clark, so this is a very special tribute to him, and it would hopefully kick off a series of events throughout the year.
Yeah,
but I want to say, especially, you know, what you said today being so profound, and that is that when you can attribute a change in your life, a change in your attitude and perceptions and your knowledge, and you're conscious of that change, it is a great, great thing. And to be part of that is a great honor. So I thank you for saying that. This program has done that for you. I thank you. And I thank you all the more for attributing it to the collective. You know, it's everybody putting something in the pot that has affected you in a very positive way.
Indeed. And I want to, like I said, I want to say thank you, Utrecht. Thank you to the listeners, and thank you to your guests. And I'm hoping we can do this for the next, you know, how many years we got, you know, we got left. So thank you.
Thank you.
And thank everybody.
Thanks so much. From Los Angeles, DX, you're going to be the last caller. You're going to have to kind of put it in pricey form, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Hi, Utrecht. How are you today, first of all?
Thank you so much for your call today.
Okay. How are you? And I was wanting to say a Happy New Year to all the listeners out there, all the wonderful commenters on callers today as well. And
thank you.
I wanted to say something really important before I get into what I was going to say. I gave a call to the number that you gave out to help Mr. Maddox, and
yes.
I'm going to wait till after the holidays to go ahead and send what I can. And I would encourage everyone to go ahead and give a call and reach down and see what you can do, because we need to help this brother. He's given us so much. He's been so willing to give his time and his advice and his knowledge and his expertise, and I feel like we really need to help him.
And I am going. I'm organizing something for him. It's going to be in February, I hope, and he deserves a very special tribute as well. And I'm going to see to it that he gets it.
Indeed, he does. And I would like to give that number real quick: 917-947-8994. Just whatever you can do, people, just call and try to help this man. He's been so wonderful to us, and I feel that that's very important. So,
thank you.
What I wanted to talk about, and it'll be real quick, is that this so-called spending bill that they passed, the Congress passed before they went on vacation, some are dubbing it the Cromnibus, and I guess it funds the government for another extra 3 months or so. But the really, really sneaky part and the really, really... I mean, just the part that's going to screw us over is this part of the bill that was inserted about the banks. And what it does is it rolls back one of the very important parts of the very few limitations that the Dodd-Frank Act put on these banks. And what that is that the Dodd-Frank Act, as I understand it, mandated that these banks cannot take FDI-insured funds and gamble with them and derivatives and risky betting. This part of this provision in this bill not only was written by lobbyists from J.P. Morgan Chase, three of them, but also when it was time for this bill to get signed, it was also lobbied for by Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan, and by the president, Mr. Obama.
So well, he's having problems with his own party over his support of this bill. We talked a little bit about that, not nearly as detailed as we ought to.
Right, and I saw an interview with Maxine Waters, who was against this from the beginning, and what she said is that 19 other members of the Black Caucus started getting together names of all Democrats in their caucus to call them to encourage them not to vote for this bill. And every one of them had already been contacted either by Jamie Dimon or by the president himself, encouraging them to vote for this bill. So this shows me here that this guy here doesn't care. I'm talking about the president. He doesn't care about the average person. All he cares about is these people with all this money. Obviously, it's going to screw us over. And I think that this is their solution. When I say their, I'm talking about the J.P. Morgan Bank, J.P. Morgan Chase, and the other big banks. This is their solution to the ugliness of what they call a bail-in, which is what they pulled in Cyprus, if you remember.
But this is only part of it, DX. This is a part of the huge the benefits that the big money, especially the banking community, has derived from this government. This administration has been, I mean, you look at the role of the U.S. Attorney General, basically, you know, just let's pay up some money, we'll fine you, pay the money, and we'll forget any criminal prosecutions and so forth. It's been a really horrible thing. We will be looking at that in greater depth, but thank you for bringing that to our attention today. Thanks for calling, and the very best of everything for the rest of the year, but we'll see each other Monday, I hope, as we continue toward the end of the year. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
I just want to announce that on Sunday, I'm going to be at the REFAL headquarters in Newark, New Jersey. That's at 269-271 South 9th Street. We'll be celebrating Kwanzaa there, and I've been invited, so I'm going to show up, and I'll have a little talk as well on that Sunday, December the 28th. For more information, 862-231-1940. REFAL headquarters, at 269-271 South 9th Street, and doors open at 3:30 p.m. And again, I'm pushing this very special tribute to our master teacher, John Henrik Clark, who would be 100 years this year. We're having a very special tribute to him. Noted scholars will be there. Diplomats will be there. But most importantly, this is meant to be a community tribute. All these folks, all these years, we all have been beneficiaries of Dr. Clark's lifelong work and his contribution to our consciousness is just indisputable. So we want you to show up and be part of this history-making event, and it is meant to show his widow, Mrs. Sybil Williams Clark, that he has not at all been forgotten. His contributions are not at all forgotten, and we respect him, we honor him, we love him, and we are grateful to him for the work that he has done all those years. And even though he is gone, he is still with us. And I'm hoping that you would join me and join everybody else. There's going to be a choir singing, and it's drumming. It's going to be wonderful, a wonderful gathering on January the 9th. It's Friday, January the 9th at 7 p.m., and that is going to be at Convent Avenue Baptist Church. It's at 145th Street and Convent Avenue in the city of Harlem, not far from where Dr. John Henrik Clark himself had lived. So I'm looking forward to that. It's a big, big event for me. I'm privileged to have been asked to put it together. And we're doing so, a whole group of us, we're all working toward the same end, to just have this wonderful testimonial to kick off the centennial of his birth. And with that, throughout the year, there would be related activities all over the country honoring and commemorating his 100th year. I also want to thank you all for the continued high level of functioning of this program. It would not be that way without you maintaining a high level of input, and I thank you so much for that. It is a great honor to be the steward of a show that functions at that level. You do me really, really proudly. And so I thank you very, very much for that. It is always, as I say, a pleasure and a great privilege, and I mean that, a great privilege to be in your company. I will be soon mounting a fundraising event to assist Alton Maddox. He has to fight the state. The community is so much at a disadvantage without him in the court. And all of his work, all these years, has just not been because he's charged anybody for it. He has done his work, mostly, almost all of his work. In fact, I don't know any case that he hasn't done pro bono. And he hasn't asked me to do anything. Nobody has asked me to do anything. But I am going to step forward, and I'm going to publicly acclaim that this man is a hero of our community, and we ought to stand by him and support him. And I intend to do that to the fullest. And I hope if I am standing by myself, it's all right. But I know I will not, because there are so many people who value his contribution to the community. And now more than ever, as we see the way things are unfolding, we know how badly we need him. And we need him back in fine fighting shape in the court, and we will have to support that. So you can count on me. I'm going to be doing something as soon as I can get their blessing and to go ahead and do it. I will proceed and keep you posted. So thank you so much for today. A pleasure and a privilege to be in your company. Have yourselves a good weekend. We'll see each other again on Monday, God willing, and the creek don't rise. So here are the Lara brothers with some more parang from Trinidad.